So finally, we're all in agreement about what's going on with the adults. Milhouse. Okay, here's what we've got. The Rand Corporation, in conjunction with the Saucer People.
Thank you.
Under the supervision of the Reverse Vampires. Are forcing our parents to go to bed early in a fiendish plot to eliminate the meal of dinner. We're through the looking glass here, people.
A conspiracy theory there from Bart Simpson and Milhouse Van Houten. Conspiracy theories have long been a part of the American psyche, with concerns going back at least as far as the Revolutionary War. But our next guest writes that there's a surge of this type of thinking today, which she says often happens at times of change and social upheaval. Anna Merlin is a journalist at GEO's investigative division, the Special Projects Desk. Her new book is called Republic of Lies, American Conspiracy Theorists and Their Surprising Rise to Power. Anna, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I want to start on a cruise. This is where you first really started to explore this issue of conspiracy theories, a sea cruise. Tell us about that.
So in January of 2016, I went on a week-long cruise for conspiracy theorists called the Conspiracy, that went to Mexico and back. And on the cruise, I noticed that a lot of people from different conspiracy communities were really excited about Donald Trump and really saw him as a truth teller in a style that they enjoyed and were excited about the prospect of his, you know, potential presidency. And I wondered what was going to happen to those folks and other people that Trump was sort of revitalizing when he lost the election. And then he didn't. So really my impetus for writing this book was trying to understand, you know, how conspiracy communities were influencing the United States and really trying to come to terms with things about the U.S. that I don't think that I fully understood.
Let's talk about what a conspiracy theory is, if you have a working definition. And of course, nobody wants to be told that they are participating in a conspiracy theory.
Right. So a conspiracy theory is the idea that a hidden, powerful group of people are working in secret to effect some negative change or do something that impacts the common good in a negative way. And a conspiracy is when a group of people are working in secret against the common good.
And you write that a problem in some cases in debunking or challenging conspiracy theories is there are real world examples of people working together to do harm to others.
Right. Especially in the United States, there are so many examples, particularly of the government doing things in secret that are, you know, outrageous and have really damaged the public trust for years and decades.
We're talking to Anna Merlin. Her new book is Republic of Lies, American Conspiracy Theorists and Their Surprising Rise to Power. Anna, why would this last couple of years be a ripe ground for conspiracy theories?
Right. Well, you know, we know from a lot of studies, particularly in the United States, that conspiracy theories tend to well up again during times of social change, social upheaval, when we're really questioning who we are and our values. And that has certainly been true since the election of Donald Trump. And even before that, you know, we saw a rise in conspiracy theories during the Obama presidency, especially on the far right and among militia groups, you know, concerns about the Obama administration taking away people's guns, things of that nature. So the more polarized we get politically, the more conspiracy theories we're going to see.
And this isn't a new thing in some ways. You point in your book toward big surges in conspiracy theories over American history. Can you point toward a couple of those?
I mean, we can talk about something like the Salem witch trials is a really good example. You know, it was, you know, literally a belief that there was a group of people working in secret to serve a powerful adversary, in that case, Satan. You know, also, there have been sort of any number of hysterias, especially about perceived outside groups. We know that before World War I, for instance, most of the conspiracy theories in the United States were about groups like Jews, Catholics, Freemasons, Mormons, people who were believed to be plotting to seize control or infiltrate the government. And then after World War I, as the government grew larger, most of the conspiracy theories began to be about the government itself and who was really in charge of it.
There's one new element, though, that wasn't there for all of those, the internet and now social media. How do you see that fitting into the conspiracy theory landscape?
Yeah, I see social media as much more of an impact than the internet at large. Social media allows conspiracy communities to find each other, to fuse together, and it allows more and more people to see conspiratorial ideas who might not have been exposed to them before. And the effect that that has is sort of still being studied. But anecdotally, we definitely know that conspiracy communities get a lot more eyes on them. And some conspiracy theories like QAnon, a sort of bizarre pro-Trump conspiracy theory, are entirely creations of social media.
You've used the word community, talking about conspiracy theories. And in the book, you talk about spending a lot of time with people who get together to have events related to their whatever their conspiracy theory is. Do you see that as part of the appeal, that it's bringing together a group of people, a group of people who think they have it right and everybody else who has it wrong?
Yeah, absolutely. A lot of people that I talk to, whatever their particular idea is, it has brought them purpose, meaning, a perceived community, even if it's not one in real life and it's only one that exists on social media. But most importantly, I think it gives people a way to feel like they are participating, especially people who have previously felt really locked out of systems of power, have felt like they don't have a way to impact public officials, the government, public opinion. They really feel that they are participating. And a lot of times this participation is extremely negative when it comes to communities, for instance, who believe, you know, that every mass shooting is faked with the help of crisis actors, or communities of people making anti-vaccination claims. But there is no question that it is a community nonetheless.
And it's a community with celebrities in some cases. You look at, and you had a very brief chat, I believe, with Alex Jones.
I did, yes. I met Alex Jones at the RNC, the Republican National Convention, when that was happening before the presidential elections. And I wrote about the fact that, you know, I had this brief kind of bizarre conversation with Alex Jones that I wasn't inclined to take very seriously. Meanwhile, as it turned out, he was there meeting with Roger Stone, who was then an advisor to Donald Trump. You know, Alex Jones was there on serious business that I simply didn't take into account.
We're talking to Anna Merlin, author of the book Republic of Lies, American Conspiracy Theorists and Their Surprising Rise to Power. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you see a rise in conspiracy theories and conspiratorial thinking? Do you see it in person, on the internet, in your social media feed? What does it mean for our culture and our politics? What do you think drives it? If you're something who doesn't think something is a theory at all, how does being called a conspiracy theorist affect you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our exploration of modern conspiracy theories and the effects they have on our politics and our culture. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think is the appeal of conspiracy theories? What leads them to thrive? Is it social change, fear of people who are different? What do you think conspiracy theories tell us about ourselves, about humanity? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Anna Merlin is with us. Her new book is called Republic of Lies, American Conspiracy Theorists and Their Surprising Rise to Power. Anna, at some points in my life, I think conspiracy theories looked maybe kind of quaint. You know, some odd loners would get into them. It seems like more and more these days they actually have a real and often negative, as you said, effects on the real world. What happened?
I think there is a perception that conspiracy theories used to be harmless and now they're not, which is not necessarily accurate. You know, as we've discussed, they've bubbled up at various times in American history and have had an ill effect. I think the other thing that has been sort of poorly understood is that a lot of conspiracy theories are a sort of direct response to social inequality. You know, there's a lot of research to show that conspiracy theories are slightly more common among people of color, for instance, and there are conspiracy theories that are really specific to Black Americans because those conspiracy theories are based in actual outrages that have been committed against the Black community in the United States for years. You know, so the idea that conspiracy theories used to just be Bigfoot and now there's something more serious is not really correct, but it's understandable why people feel that way.
And conspiracy theories around the world, speaking of harmful ones, you talk about the forgery called the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. Conspiracy mm-hmm. theories often seem to find their way back to anti-Semitism in particular. Do you see that a lot in meeting with people who are conspiracy theory practitioners today?
I would say that a lot of more harmful conspiracy theories are fundamentally rooted in some kind of xenophobia or some kind of paranoia about an outside influence or enemy. And a lot of times, yeah, that does tend to come back to anti-Semitism, I think, because anti-Semitism is one of the oldest sort of forms of paranoia about an outside group supposedly taking over or taking effect. I do have people talk to me about the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, which was proved to be a forgery, you know, over 100 years ago. I do have a lot of people talking to me, whether they realize it or not, about ideas that fundamentally echo the blood libel, which is a medieval idea that Jews were kidnapping Christian children and murdering them in occult rituals. Things like Pizzagate, which is a much more modern conspiracy theory, really do kind of echo those ideas.
Let's bring on a caller now. Steve is with us in Madison. Steve, hi.
Hi, yeah. Thank you for having this guest because this is right up my fairway. I actually have a YouTube channel with 120,000 subscribers, and we talk about conspiracies. And the question I have is I've looked at a lot of different parts of what we call, which is a bad term, the conspiratorium, and some things are true and some things aren't. Does the writer of the book actually acknowledge that some of the conspiracies are true?
Yeah, we talked about that quite a bit. I mean, the whole point of the book really is the idea that the public trust has been extremely damaged by actual conspiracies that took place and were perpetrated by the U.S. government. You know, when the Church Committee in the 1970s exposed some of what the FBI had been doing, for instance, by infiltrating activist groups and civil rights communities, you know, that in itself created such a framework for people to distrust the government forever and created so many, you know, possibilities for people to believe in certain kinds of conspiracy theories. So, yeah, you know, I mean, the history of this country creates a fertile ground for conspiracy thinking.
Steve, thanks for the call. Go to Marcus now in Milwaukee. Marcus, hi.
Hi. So my comment is, again, that there's a lot of, you know, things that were thought of as conspiracy theories at the time, which sounded outlandish, such as, you know, UFOs. But then it turned out that some of these things people were actually seeing was just advanced technology that the U.S. military had created, such as, you know, the B-2 stealth bomber or the SR-71 Blackbird. And then there's also stuff like the group MC Ultra, where they talk about, you know, that they tried to do mind control. Well, they did experiment with LSD on people with the Tuskegee experiment to see, you know, as well as other ones at UCLA Berkeley to see how people's minds would relate and, you know, and what they could actually do to manipulate a mind.
Marcus, thanks for the call. A couple different things there. MK Ultra was the LSD one that did happen. The Tuskegee experiment was a horrific syphilis experiment. But again,
yeah,
pointing towards bad things. Yeah.
Yeah, we're kind of conflating a few different things. MK Ultra was a CIA mind control program. It was the CIA trying to determine if they could actually create a mind control program and use it for military purposes. The other thing is the Tuskegee experiments, which was a group of Black men with syphilis were purposely allowed to continue having the disease in order to test the progression of the disease long after the government knew what the cure was. So again, there's all these examples in U.S. history of real conspiracies that have led people to believe that just about anything is possible. Another one that he did not mention, but I think was being referred to, was the idea that the government was secretly dosing people with LSD, which is true.
Thanks for the call. In our last few minutes, Anna, let's talk about what we do about this and how we know, given that, yes, some bad things have happened, how do we know from the midst of an outlandish conspiracy theory that isn't true?
Right. I mean, I think the fundamental argument of the book is that the more that we create a just and transparent society, the less need there will be for conspiracy theories, because there will be less for people to conspiracy theorize about. For instance, we're seeing a lot of paranoia right now and a lot of conspiracy theories about rigged voting machines, the idea that, you know, President Trump isn't going to step down when his term in office is over, which is actually a conspiracy theory that also came up about President Obama at the end of his term. So the idea, if we have a more directly representative democracy, that there will be fewer conspiracy theories, for instance, about rigged voting, I think is very persuasive and very effective. And so we see that throughout American society. There are so many conspiracy theories about the medical establishment, about, you know, the IRS and taxes. All of these systems are in really fundamental need of reform in order to produce fewer conspiracy theories about them, which is a frustrating answer and one that will take us a really long time, but is, in my view, the best way to address these things.
Is it easier to just believe in a really out there conspiracy theory about something that is genuinely bad than it is to take action to try to fix the real problems?
I don't know if it's easier necessarily, but I think those things have a really strong emotional appeal for a lot of people. And again, as we've talked about, can make, you know, some logical sense. And, you know, it's worth stressing too that not every conspiracy community is sort of equally harmful. I write in the book about going to a UFO conference. And while some corners of the UFO world, you know, are delving into some genuinely weird and not so positive stuff, the general idea that maybe we're not alone in the universe and having a curiosity about other forms of life elsewhere in the galaxy, you know, is a pretty, in a way, beneficial thing.
We'll leave it there for now. Anna, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Anna Merlin, journalist at Geo Media in New York. Her new book is called Republic of Lies, American Conspiracy Theorists and Their Surprising Rise to Power. Climate change is transforming our world in many ways, from extreme weather events to rising seas to more frequent wildfires. A Wisconsin researcher who studies lakes is drawing attention to another one. Mercury is now moving in unexpected ways. That has some big implications for human health. WPR's Sarah Weitz-Kotacek has more.
Jeff Rubsum works for UW-Madison and the Department of Natural Resources. In mid-March, he drilled into ice on a northern Wisconsin lake to take water samples.
The ice is frozen on top, and then there's kind of a slush layer in there, and then you start into hard ice again.
Rubsum's boss is Carl Watrous. Watrous has studied mercury levels for 32 years. He discovered when water levels go up, mercury in fish does too. And then the opposite occurs. When water levels go down, mercury levels go down.
It's like a roller coaster going downhill, and that's because climate has kicked in, and we've seen dramatic changes in water levels over the past 30 years or so.
Mercury is a neurotoxin that harms the brain, especially in kids. Coal-fired plants are the biggest emitter of mercury into the atmosphere. About two-thirds of mercury in the environment is from past emissions. And it doesn't leave once it's there, says MIT atmospheric chemist Noelle Saline.
So this is why climate ends up being really important, because of this important impact of the legacy mercury that continues to affect us. And the flip side of that is also that the mercury that we're emitting today turns into tomorrow's legacy mercury.
The mercury in the atmosphere gets into fish when it rains down into plants and trees that decompose in water. So when water levels go up, plants on the lake's edge are submerged and start to die. And when there are higher levels of water, more trees decompose and release more mercury into the lake. The DNR's Carl Watrous points to some dying trees at Little Rock Lake in northern Wisconsin.
Can you see those two pines that are right there? Their needles are sort of yellowish rather than deep green. They are probably on their way out.
Wisconsin began to regulate mercury in 2004. Since then, concentrations in lakes have gone down. But the Trump administration wants to roll back plans to reduce mercury into the environment. Some advocates worry Wisconsin's DNR may do the same. Julie Enslow is an environmental activist for the grassroots organization Milwaukee 350. She spoke at a Sierra Club news conference in Milwaukee in April. She's against a proposal by the utility company We Energies to increase the amount of mercury it can discharge at its Oak Creek power plant near Milwaukee each day.
We Energies should be here today, and they should be standing here apologizing for the polluting of Lake Michigan, not asking to increase that pollution.
We Energy spokesman Brendan Conway says while the utility is asking for more flexibility in the amount of mercury it discharges day to day, its overall goal is to emit less.
We live in this community as well, right? We know how important it is. We care deeply about the environmental sustainability and about public safety and about public health.
Carl Watrous with the DNR says even with future emission reductions, it will be hard to see progress. With water levels fluctuating from climate change, even lower mercury emissions may not always lead to cleaner fish. Sarah Weitz-Kotacek, WPR News.
Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, a number of corporations are taking public political stances, sometimes even on divisive issues. We'll look at the changing face of corporate activism, whether it makes a difference, and whether it costs companies money when they do it. A lot of us have a complicated relationship with all the things we buy and own. Psychologist Regan Gurung joins us for a look at stuff and what it says about us, and you can join the conversation with your own story as well. And Apple is killing iTunes, but it looks like everybody gets to keep their music files. We'll look at the ever-changing ways we listen to music, from albums to CDs to downloads to nowadays streaming. Almost said screaming. And you can share your story. Do you keep a bunch of vinyl around still? Do you buy new vinyl albums? Do you have a big CD collection? Have you gotten rid of it and gone completely digital? If so, how? And have you liked it? Call in now. Share your story at 833-424-3327. That's 833-424-3327. And leave us a message. That's coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.